hosting Hochatown. I'm Jay Wesley Lindley with Shiloh Brock-Martin. Mike Mazey is joining us on hosting Hochatown today. Thank you, Mike. We appreciate you joining us. We've spent some time looking through your plan that you've laid out, and we wanted to give you a chance just to explain here on our podcast how you see it working for the greater good of Oklahoma.
Thanks so much for having me, Jay and Shiloh. Love talking about the Mazey plan.
The campaign says the goal is lower costs, fix what's broken. When you say fix what's broken, what are some of the first things you believe Oklahoma needs to fix?
Well, after serving 12 years in the state Senate and then 2 years as Oklahoma's Secretary of Finance, it became very apparent to me that our tax code is broken because we're losing, you know, great energy headquarters like Devon to the no-income tax state of Texas. Our seniors are terrified about losing their houses because their property taxes have gone up 40, 50%. We're 49th in education, gentlemen, which is completely unacceptable. And we've got this public safety threat of, you know, Chinese money involved with, you know, land and drugs and the Mexican cartel. So I built a concrete plan with real solutions to make Oklahoma a no-income tax state, abolish property taxes for seniors and veterans, launch a massive statewide literacy program so our students read at grade level, and enforce the Oklahoma Constitution by securing the land of Oklahoma for the people of Oklahoma and get rid of these bad foreign adversary actors.
Wow, that is super concrete. I'm not a super political person. You know, I don't always understand how, you know, the legislature works and exactly what the governor does. But with a plan like that, you know, how long do you anticipate for us to start seeing some of those results? I have heard a little bit about your plan for education, and I understand that, you know, modeling it after some other states and adding your own twist to it. How long would it take to see some of those results?
Well, let's start with that one, because in my first week as governor, I will hire a statewide literacy director to launch an Oklahoma version of the very successful Mississippi model, which took them from 50th to first in the country in reading outcomes. Now, I got the privilege to visit with Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders in Arkansas, who basically did exactly that in her first year as governor. And to answer your question, they've had 2 full years in the program now, and the data is out that shows reading proficiency the past year for first graders and second graders is up 100%.
Wow.
So yes. I believe when we launch a statewide literacy program in the first year of a Mazey administration with, you know, phonics based curriculum, reading coaches, a third grade reading gate for accountability, we will see immediate results in year 2, year 3, and year 4 of a Mazey administration.
I think that's something that's super important to both Jay and I. He's a school board member. I believe in education, went the college route and all that. And it was always, you know, a little disheartening to me to see my state at the bottom of those lists. And so I think that's an amazing plan. And we've seen the proof in the other states. I mean, we're seeing success, and there's only one way to go when you're number 50 or 49.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I married a teacher, and this is one of the big reasons my wife, Noelle, and I decided to run for governor.
Speaking on education and taxes there a little bit, you've talked about lowering the income tax and eliminating property taxes on the homestead for seniors and veterans. How do you plan on getting there while protecting schools and local services that need some of those tax dollars?
Yeah, a very important question. I've always been a reformer in state service, while I've always, you know, maintained my Oklahoma small business and, you know, worked for 35 years as a certified financial planner. So I like to tell people, gentlemen. I'm pro-reform and I'm anti-chaos.
Nice.
There's a responsible way to roll out reforms. So let's start with property taxes. As I got to, you know, just experience firsthand the fear that our seniors and veterans have had across the state, because they thought they might lose their homes due to these skyrocketing property taxes, I dove into the numbers, and what I found is that for most Oklahoma counties, urban and rural, property tax collections for seniors 65 and older on the homestead, you know, their residence, only accounts for 10% of total county property tax collections. Well, then I also found that in the urban counties, property tax collections were going up 5-7% per year. And in the rural counties, property tax collections were growing about 3-4% per year. So then I just sort of came up with this plan. If we phase it out, generally 3 years for the urban counties and probably something like 6 years in the rural counties, over time, what we will still see happening in all of our counties is a net gain of 2-3% growth in property tax collections still while we're going through the phase out process for our seniors. Therefore, if property tax receipts are still growing 2-3% per year, the cash flow necessary for county services and the courthouse and the sheriff's department and the payments for school bonds, which is basically what local property taxes pay for, not the teacher salaries and that's elsewhere, then all those payments will be just fine.
Yeah, that sounds great. You know, if you don't have to concede anywhere and you can still, you know, do that for both veterans and the, you know, over 60, 65 crowd. I mean, I have no problem with that. And I don't know anybody in the right hand that would.
Yeah. If I could throw in one more piece, what's happened with property taxes is really become un-American for retirees. Because what's happened, fellas, is let's say your parents or, you know, grandparents, you know, bought a house for $50,000. And now it's worth $200,000. Well, they're having to pay tax on what we finance guys call an unrealized gain. Mm-hmm. They're paying tax on something they've never actually benefited from in terms of cash. So I've had people tell me all over the state, Mike, I can't retire because I got to come up with the cash for my property taxes. Or I'm on a fixed income as a retiree, so I've had to choose between either paying my property tax so I don't lose my house and not paying my homeowner's insurance because it's gone up 40-50%. I just can't afford to do both. We do have a plan to bring those costs down as well, but it's just really become ask these seniors of ours who have contributed to the local communities for 4-5 decades to pay rent basically to the government to live in their homes.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I've always had a little bit of a trouble with when thinking about property tax. You know, it's like I don't ever really own this then, you know.
Yeah, it feels like that.
Yeah.
I can understand being taxed when I sell, you know, like a stock or something. But
sure.
I've always had a hard time understanding, you know, even tagging my vehicle. Sometimes I have a hard time understanding that. But I get that.
Income taxes is a separate reform issue. We can dive into that whenever you want to.
Oh, yeah.
Let's please.
That's one right great now caveat. Because yeah. I think that's a huge, huge topic that people want to hear about. I mean, like you said, we're losing businesses to Texas because they have it. And, you know, for us, we're 20, 30 miles from the Texas border. I mean, we're right here. We're seeing teachers go across the border, you know, for state different line, reasons. Yeah. We're seeing, you know, we're really close to Texas and Arkansas, actually. So, you know, we're seeing people, you know, commute further to different jobs. So I'd love to hear about the no income tax for sure.
Yeah, I've been studying the no income tax states for quite a while. And the model that I found that really is best for us is Tennessee. They've had 58% more economic growth than Oklahoma over a 10-year period. And I get that they have Opryland, but you know, they do not have oil and natural gas like we do. And most of the oil and natural gas states don't have a state income tax. And so in the first year of a Massey administration, our plan involves reducing the state income tax from 4.5% to 3% in one big shift as step one in a three-part program over a period of years, because or by literally cleaning up $2 billion worth of giveaway items and deductions, rebates, credits, you know, exemptions that the no income tax states just don't have. And what that allows us to do is drop the rate in what we finance guys call a revenue neutral process. You clean up this mess over here and you lower the rates over here, and you end up with a wash. Mm-hmm. We don't gain any tax collections, but we don't lose any tax collections either. And I know this to be true and accurate because if people walk through their own individual returns and they subsequently call up the Oklahoma Tax Commission, they'll tell you that the effective tax rate, which is basically the amount of tax divided into total income that people actually pay, the effective tax rate for 1.8 million income taxpayers across the state is not 4.5%, which is our current income tax rate. The effective tax rate is 3.1%. So it's very doable and it's very responsible. Step two takes that another direction. I've kind of calculated how, but with some additional cleanup, we can get to probably around 2.5%. At that point, the people of Oklahoma would actually have to vote the way our system works and choose, do I want to have an activity model like Tennessee that does tax activity a la some sales and services that we don't tax, but all the no income tax states do. The best example I can give everyone is for those of us that are Oklahoma City Thunder fans, when we buy a ticket to go to the Paycom Center and watch the game, the fans don't pay a sales tax. But over in the state of Tennessee, if you want to go to this entertainment experience, if you will, and watch the Memphis Grizzlies of the NBA play, you pay a sales tax. So I put the question to both of you, if the people of Oklahoma, or at least the NBA Thunder fans, didn't have to pay a state income tax, but they did have to pay a sales tax on their tickets to go to the game, how many of those 19,000 star-raving NBA Thunder fans would go, oh, I'm not going to go to the game. I got to pay a sales tax on the ticket.
No.
I'd say at least one. There's going to be one guy. But other than that. Yeah.
I'll take one out of 19.
Yeah, me too. I'll take those odds any day.
I can live with that, Shiloh.
Me too. Yeah. I didn't even know that. That's so interesting. I had no clue that when you bought a ticket that you didn't, which I'm so far away. And Jay's an affiliate. He's never taken me to a game. I don't know why.
I've offered him tickets.
Maybe we could all go to one.
There you go. Yeah. Perfect.
I try to go at least a couple times a year.
That'll be how we celebrate when you win. We'll go to a game.
And here's what's so crazy about a Republican runoff. When I hear the arguments against becoming a no income tax state from my opponent, He sounds like a liberal Democrat.
Yeah.
Ooh, you know, man. These Republican states that are no income tax states have better roads, better education outcomes, more law enforcement officers, and, you know, and higher paying jobs. But, you know, I'm running against this liberal, you know, Republican in name only who says, oh, no, we can't do anything. We can't change the system. It's a plan, you know, it's all gimmicks. It'll just be crash and burn. Well, that's the arguments I heard when I was in the state Senate doing cutting taxes, reforming the tax code from all the Democrats.
I did have one question, if it's all right, not to pull too far away from taxes, because that is a very interesting that's a piece of information I think a lot of our listeners just didn't know about. Yeah. Using entertainment tax as an example. Before we do have to get into firefighter pensions, because
let's clear that.
I know Shiloh wants to get to that.
Those falsehoods.
Before we do that, though, I did have one more question, because we hadn't talked about jobs, and you have mentioned more high-paying jobs. Maybe you could call it your centerpiece of the campaign, even possibly. What does that mean? What does that mean for Southeast Oklahoma?
Yeah, I love that question, because I have a jobs and commerce working group, gentlemen, that is literally collaborating with my agriculture working group. So our economic growth plan includes the needs and opportunities of rural Oklahoma. Let me put it to you like this. The second component of my economic growth plan, after fixing the tax code, as we just discussed, is to get the 7,500 students off of the 29 career tech systems or campuses across the state of Oklahoma, most of which are in rural Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And from what I've heard in Southeast Oklahoma, do you consider Muskogee Southeast Oklahoma down there?
They consider themselves Southeast Oklahoma.
I don't.
We're way
I bring it up just because I was there last week.
Okay.
And one of the instructors there told me that at Indian Capital Technology Center, they have 250 students on the waiting list to become welders. Well, we need welders all over the state of Oklahoma, from what I'm told by small business owners, but we're leaving 7,500 students out there. A ton of these, you know, waiting lists are in Southeast rural Oklahoma, like Muskogee, and they want to be welders. The second most popular program, I'm told, is nursing. And then you've got healthcare technicians and nursing assistants. And then you've got HVAC technicians. And one of the best things we can do, according to what we call the Maisie Rural Advisors Council, we just had our get together with that group on a virtual meeting from friends across the state, is get those young men and women in rural Oklahoma these skilled trades, and then they have the option of being employed in rural Oklahoma.
One thing that Oklahoma has been for a long time is we've been a really good exporter of our youth.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a great point.
They go to these other states with higher paying jobs. I mean, I was in the same boat. I've talked about it on the podcast with other people. I mean, when I went to college, I never thought I'd make it back to Broken Bow.
You know,
I thought I'm going to go to college and I'll go down to Dallas, you know, and I studied occupational safety. I thought I'll get a safety job down there and I'll never be back. And, you know,
big thanks to tourism that you did get to come back.
Huge
sure.
Thanks to tourism in our part that, you know, we have seen some economical growth. And I've been lucky enough to have a few different jobs in my career field before switching to the fire service. And
can I give you guys proof of when you mix proper education focus with tax policy that keeps young men and women in Oklahoma?
Yes, sir. Please.
So when I was in the state Senate, I authored what's called the Aerospace Engineer Tax Credit. And we had this problem where engineers coming out of OU, OSU, and some of our, you know, 22 colleges across the state, including in rural Oklahoma, They get their degrees and they go off to Dallas because there were aerospace companies there and they didn't have to pay income taxes. So we wrote this recruitment strategy tax credit plan. And in essence, the tax credit allows these engineers coming out of Oklahoma colleges to not pay state income tax for 5 years.
Whoa.
Well, lo and behold, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. The last count I saw was like 500 some. I think it's now over 600 that have graduated from Oklahoma College, stayed in Oklahoma, one of our aerospace facilities, Boeing, Spirit, Aerosystems, Nordam. There's more and more of these companies starting to mushroom across the state, including some projects that I've heard about in development in Southeast Oklahoma. And we did lose, according to the data, about $10 million worth of income tax collections. But the economic impact benefit turned out to be, I'm not making this up, I've got a report that actually shows this, at $1 billion.
Whoa. With a B.
So that, with a B. That's why it's so important to, one, become a no income tax state, and two, get our young people that want to be in a career tech program with a skill that our business owners want. And then, or in a higher education, in a career that our business owners need. And when you mix the power of education with proper tax policy, we will not only keep young men and women in Oklahoma, I believe, will attract people from Oklahoma that just feel like, you know, there's a few too many people in Dallas and North Texas. I want to go to Southeast Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. we're seeing a little bit of it already before, the good news of that nice mixture you're talking about. So I invite it and look forward to it.
Yeah.
So that's
awesome. Continue that growth for sure.
Well, now I think, the moment that I have been waiting for.
Yes.
I am a career fireman. And
thank you for your service.
Well, thank you for allowing me to do it, and thanks to everyone for the support. I love being a fireman, because no matter what happens, man, we the public, they seem to love us. The cops, they get a little bit of a bad rap sometimes, but there's always a plate of cookies or some brownies at the fire station, and I just appreciate everyone that does that for us. I didn't really know the pension thing, I guess what people are saying about your thoughts on the
plan,
pension.
And
until I seen a video of a guy who I, follow and I really like as a fireman, he basically put out a video saying, hey, I don't care who you vote for governor, but vote for anybody but Mike Massey, because he's going to take your pension. And I'm like, whoa, I better not vote for Mike. He's going to take my pension.
Right.
And so I think it's only fair that, we set the record straight right here, right now.
Maybe what you are proposing versus what you're not proposing.
Or tell us maybe where that come from. I know that, some things were posted about from your website, from your campaign that they kind of highlighted and said, this right here is the proof that we need. And since then, Your website has changed, which I'm guessing just changed to reflect what you really meant about county pensions and things like that. But yeah, just kind of go wild with it. Tell us everything there is to know about pensions and plans for pensions.
Yes. I so appreciate the opportunity to get the truth out there, because a lot of times what happens in these campaigns is there's misinformation, there's blatant falsehoods. And, by the end of the campaigns, the people of Oklahoma have to decide, or the voters have to decide, who's telling the truth and who's using falsehoods. So I have never advocated changing the defined benefit plan for firefighters when I was in the state Senate. And I literally, gentlemen, am the guy who worked for 7 years to fix the firefighter system, which today would be bankrupt if I hadn't worked so hard on that. Or income tax rates for the people of Oklahoma would be 10 or 11% like they are in Illinois because of their disastrous pension stuff. Furthermore, since I rescued the firefighter pension system, and you can talk to just loads of firefighters across the state who are aware of my work. One of your representatives at the time was Phil Ostrander. Some people know that name. There's the legendary firefighter from the Oklahoma City bombing, Ralph Crawford. Mm-hmm. There's a friend of mine who's the chairman of our public safety working group, former Tulsa chief of the Tulsa Fire Department, Ray Driscoll. And I could go on and on and on that know completely my history and the absurdity of these falsehoods. So as governor, I will never support a change to the defined benefit plan for firefighters, because when I was chairman of the Select Committee on Pensions, we always communicated to everyone, hey, the hazard duty professions, the pensions for these individuals of the firefighter community, the police officer community, the state trooper community, they take on a level of risk that is totally different than what, you know, a traditional state employee or a county employee might take on. And not only that, but once they do it, they stay in for 10, 15, 20, 30 years. And so they always need this extra level of security and benefit for not only themselves, but for their surviving spouses and, you know, family if something happens to them. And the personal kind of frustration here, you know, for me as a financial planner who works so hard to fix these things is, like I mentioned earlier on the tax arguments, when I was in the state Senate, I was accused of all the things like this that you're hearing now from Democrats. Mm-hmm. Hey, Mazie's going to wreck this and Mazie's going to do that. And we eventually fought through all that misinformation. So now what my, you know, political opponents did is they took a tactic right out of the Democrat playbook, and they took one sentence from a piece of cost savings that we put on the website, because I do like to give people actual details of how stuff can work, that was relevant for county government.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Office workers for two out of the Oklahoma 77 counties. It really only applied to Tulsa County and Oklahoma County, and it had absolutely nothing to do with firefighters, police officers, or state troopers.
Right.
Because without diving you too much into the weeds, the new workforce that's coming in, you know, these office jobs in state government, a lot of times they only stay 5 to 7 years on average now. Okay. Unlike you guys, yeah, that do 10, 20, 30 years, and they don't like these defined benefit plans because
they want to take them with them.
When they move to the next job, they want to take their money with them.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So that is literally all I was talking about. But I'm, you know, my opponent's a skilled liberal trial lawyer, and like trial lawyers do, they take one sentence and turn it into something that it's totally not. And then they, you know, they get some folks like some of your friends to believe it. So I really appreciate the opportunity to get the truth out versus the absurd falsehoods. Not only that, but I'm the only one in this race that understands how to get the firefighter system even more solid. I wasn't a part of something that happened, and now we're really getting into the weeds. I apologize.
That's all right.
No, you're good.
We live in the weeds.
That's right.
One of the reasons the firefighter system is not up to the 95% funded level that the police system is because what's called insurance premium tax revenue was diverted away from the firefighter system into the general budget for the politicians to spend as they wanted during some tough budget years. And I've told people for years, and I'm telling you all and your listeners that I'm one of the few, if maybe the only person that's advocated for, we've got to shift that insurance premium tax dedicated revenue back to the firefighter system. So it pours extra money in there on top of what's called the employer contributions and the employee contributions.
Mm-hmm, right.
So it catches up to this 90, 95% level so that I, as governor, can advocate regular cost of living adjustments for retired firefighters.
So
that's important.
It's huge. Jay, your father-in-law is a retired firefighter.
Literally where I was going for retired firefighters, like my father-in-law, who was chief here in Broken Bow for a few years. The concern may not be whether the pension's there, but whether it's going to keep up with the cost of living. Yeah. Is,
which they haven't the last 20 years because they had to get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to fix it to an even higher level now.
Now, you authored a bill when you were in the Senate that fixed some of those cost of living adjustments, or am I making that up?
I ran a lot of bills over a period of 7 years that sort of, you know, stopped the bleeding, and then it ended the special giveaway that the liberal Democrats had created for themselves, which, you know, and then got them extra funding, and it was just one step after the next. Until basically after 7 years, fellas, we knew that, okay, the next 10 or 15 years, these things are going to go from, if you looked at all of them at the time, there's seven pension systems. But when I got to the Senate, the whole combined unit was only 50% funded.
Oh, wow.
Today, the whole combined unit is almost 90% funded.
And where is the fire pension sitting?
The fire pension system is like 75. I haven't seen the latest actuarial report, but it's like 75 to 77% funded, whereas the police system is 96% funded. Generally, when it's, you know, 85 to 95% funded, it can afford regular cost of living adjustments.
Right.
And that's where I want to get to. One of the things that, again, was a special deal that the liberal Democrats had built for themselves is the retirement benefit you got if you were a state legislator was 100% more than the benefit you got as a firefighter, a teacher, a state employee. So literally guys that had served in the legislature, even though the legislature's only, you know, in session 4 months out of the year, we're literally getting paid, I'm not making this up, $6,000-$7,000 per month in retirement.
Oh my God. How long would they have to serve?
20 to 30 years.
Wow. Yeah, that's a...
And I'm literally the guy that eliminated that gravy train that they had set up for themselves.
Thank you.
And I was not real popular with a lot of liberal Democrat, you know, elected officials, which is kind of why there was this weaponization of misinformation back then. And, you know, unfortunately, it's been picked up by a liberal Republican, you know, running against me. How can we weaponize this issue against our opponent, even though it's untrue information?
Yeah.
Right.
I think that's awesome that, you know, being in a position like that to, because I'm guessing that affected you when you changed that, when you said, hey, we need to take this gravy train away. I mean, that in a sense affected you because you were in the legislature.
Well, the funny part was when I was Governor Stitt's first, you know, Secretary of Finance, and he was learning all this stuff. I was like, you know, Governor, you got the same deal now as a teacher. You don't get the special deal because I got rid of it.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Yeah, that one thing that
So his 8 years of service, he does get a little pension benefit after 8 years of service, or a retirement benefit. It's totally different than what all of his predecessors.
Yeah,
got.
Yeah, they're living a little better. Yeah, with pensions, I've always kind of wondered. Maybe you can speak on this, maybe not. But why are state pensions so different? Like, you know, say teachers, they're on a whole different plan, like a age plus years of service has to equal 90. And in the fire service, I know we're on the, you know, years of service and a percentage of our salary. We can qualify up to 75% of our last 30 months salary. I know with Highway Patrol, I think they can get all the way up to like 90% of their salary. What is the reason for the difference in that?
Well, boy, now we're getting into some complicated stuff, and we would need pretty much a whole seminar to go through all that.
Well, maybe we can just schedule one of those.
I can simplify it a little bit. You almost have to sort of bracket these things into three different columns. You know, column one is, you know, regular state workers that are, you know, administrative folks in, say, you know, the State Department of Transportation. So, you know, they got all these office jobs. They're not out on the roads. You know, they're just, you know, they're well-meaning individuals. It's not hazard duty.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, some of them make it careers, but like I said earlier, the new people coming into these, as we all know, this current generation of millennials and Generation Zs, they don't sort of think about a 30-year career. They think about, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'm going to do that, and then I'm going to go try this.
Yep.
Right. Well, then you've got your teachers. And teachers isn't a hazard duty thing, but it's kind of a unique and special life calling. And they tend to stay 10, 20, 30 years in teaching. You know, my wife taught for 15, 16 years, but she's still got friends that are in teaching, you know, 30 years later.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, that's not hazard duty, but it is a long-term thing that, you know, is deserving of the, you know, more generous, more I shouldn't say they're generous, but more deserving of the defined benefit approach versus the sort of 401k contribution approach for young state employees that can take the money with them. Mm-hmm. And then you got the third column of the hazard duty folks that, you know, firefighters, state troopers, that they do have long careers, but sometimes those careers get, you know, they can't go 30 years because of, you know, injuries.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you guys are putting your life on the line every day, so it deserves a higher level of security that comes with a defined benefit program. So you kind of got to think of it as you got these three types of public employees, and they each have their own sort of unique circumstances, so they then end up having, you know, different parameters.
Yeah.
I don't know if that helps. But
no, that makes perfect sense.
That's probably all we should bore your listeners with.
Yeah, no, that, you know, sometimes, Mike, I'm a little selfish, and I just ask questions that I want to know about, and I don't even care.
Happens all the time on a podcast.
I'm sure people listen.
It's what a lot of people are thinking about. It's probably why you guys are popular.
Yeah.
Well, I appreciate that. I know we're running out of time, so just stop us if it's time, you got to move on to the next one. We appreciate you. If you got a little more time, we'd love to ask a couple more questions.
Let me check the calendar.
Yes, sir.
It's, you know, with 2 days to go, I think I've only got 9 items on the calendar today. It looks like I'm okay till noon.
Okay. You talk a lot about accountability, and your accountability plan uses a pretty memorable line: no performance, no funding. What would that actually look like once you're governor?
So I've got three kind of elements there. I've talked with some legislator friends on both the House and the Senate side to reconstitute what's called the Office of State Finance, and make it the Office of State Finance and Fiscal Responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so item number one of that group will be to literally take off the shelves these numerous audit reports and incentive evaluation commission reports that have reams of suggestions and recommendations to save hundreds of millions of dollars. For example, my friend, current auditor Cindy Bird, did an audit on the SoonerCare system a few years ago and found that, excuse me, I need to sip a little water here, found a few years ago that our Medicaid system has $1.6 billion, with the B, of questionable expenses every year. And unfortunately, the legislature never did anything about it. Over in the state of Tennessee, again, they did something about it. And in their system, they came up with $1 billion worth of cash savings. So we're going to get to work on all of those audits. Second, we're going to work through and with the auditor, the incoming auditor. Her name is Melissa Capps. She's a friend. And we've already started kind of collaborating on the other 14 agencies in, you know, conjunction with the one I just referred to, basically account for 95% of the tax dollar spend. How do we get audits for these other 14 agencies so we can uncover where they're just not handling taxpayer money correctly? And that's going to lead to, you know, millions and millions of additional savings. And then three, I will require every state agency to put on my desk 90-day financial reports that compare, you know, budgeted expenses to actual expenses, a very common financial practice that happens in every business in the world, including my own small business. But shockingly, that practice does not happen in a state where we spend $32 billion.
Can I say that it feels like this is common sense that politicians are wanting to clean this up, but it also feels like that we've let it go on so long. Maybe the American people didn't ask enough questions or put enough pressure. Why now? Why is this seemingly, not that nobody has cared about it, but why does it seem such a hot button issue right now?
I think that's a good question. I think part of the MAGA movement, part of the realization that there's, you know, waste and disrespect to the taxpayers and their money, the information age has made some of this more transparent, fellas.
Yeah. Right.
And then they see President Donald Trump say, "I don't care about the folks that want to protect the status quo and just do things the same old way. We're going to get in there and deal with the nonsense." And so you've got these reports that come out that used to be, you know, behind the scenes and, you know, undercover, where, for example, the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse a couple months ago went to the legislature and said, "Hey, we know we have $780 million to spend in our budget, but we can't make payroll, so would you please give us an extra $60 million? And of course, they're all just, you know, flabbergasted. And then that gets out to the people of Oklahoma, whereas maybe 20 years ago, they would never have found out.
Yeah.
Okay. And say, by golly, something's got to be done with the waste and the fraud and the abuse and accountability to the taxpayers.
I, for one, I'm one of those guys that would rather everything just be out in the open.
Yeah, me too.
Because the way I see it, if you're not doing anything wrong, you don't have to hide anything.
100%.
So
total transparency is the key.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Yes, sir.
You know, that, like, working, you know, for a type of government, like, I've always hated, you know, when the end of the year comes, if you had budget money left over, what do you have to do?
Have to spend
you
it. You
got to
lose
spend it.
It
or you lose that, it, and then they reduce your budget because exactly. You didn't need it. And it's like, just
so you know, wasteful spending is a must at the end of the year.
Yes, it's like we encourage it.
Exactly.
And so if one department or one group is doing it, they're all doing it. Yeah. And whether it's the last $10,000 or couple million.
Exactly.
I mean, gosh, you got to imagine that adds up to such a large number. It's got to be even worse in the state government. You know, it only gets worse as you go higher in importance. You know, federal's got to be worse than state.
Astronomical federally. Yep.
Wow. You're right.
There was one thing you mentioned. You made protecting Oklahoma land from foreign control a major issue. Where do you think the current law or maybe enforcement of those laws still fall short?
Yeah, I really want to mention a couple of things there because the current director of the Oklahoma Bureau of Narcotics, Donnie Anderson, has recently said the number one public safety threat in Oklahoma is the Chinese money that's involved with, land and drugs and, the Mexican cartels. And there's been some, fluff out there about, so-and-so, marijuana grow farms have been shut down, which doesn't really pass the smell test because Director Anderson has told the public, Oklahoma has 4 million people and 1,400 marijuana grow farms, and is the number one producer of pot in the country, whereas California has 44 million people and only 100 marijuana grow farms.
Oh, wow.
And so part of this, disastrous public safety problem, which is partly why we're ranked number 13 in the country in violent crime, is just letting the gates wide open after medical marijuana was passed by the voters. Mm-hmm. And the legislature didn't put any guardrails in the system, so we became the cheapest place in the country to grow as much marijuana as you wanted on as many acres as you wanted. And of course, that attracts bad elements. Well, in 2023, fellas, the legislature passed a bill and said, hey, Attorney General, we want you to create a land purchase affidavit so that when people, process the paperwork, we can protect against these bad actors buying up land. Well, the Attorney General is also the chairman of a bank that operates all over the state, and they do publicly brag that they're the leading cannabis banker in the state and the region. So, okay, let's get this right. The chief law enforcement officer of the state of Oklahoma, who brags about shutting down all these marijuana grow farms, is also the leading banker for the cannabis industry. Does anybody not see a conflict of interest here?
I think that's the definition of a conflict of interest.
So here's what happened with the land purchase of affidavit. We've got proof of this, and we've put it out in public space. I can tell you where to find the proof. But on the land purchase affidavit, which was drafted by the Office of Attorney General, there's item number 3 on the form, and on the form it says, "I hereby certify," and you have two boxes you can check. One box says, "A citizen of the United States." Great, check that box. Buy whatever you want. But after the words United States is the word or, and it gives you the option to check the next box. I'm not making this up. I know it sounds absurd, but the next box says, "I am not a citizen of the United States, but an alien who is or shall become a bona fide resident of the state of Oklahoma." You check that box, even if you're a foreign bad actor, you buy whatever you want. And I'm told, I literally was told in the presence of an employee of a county clerk's office where these forms are processed, "Senator Mazie, After this form is processed, it goes in this drawer. Nobody ever looks at it again.
Oh, man.
And so on my first day in office, in Trump-like fashion, I will sign an executive order to abolish that unconstitutional loophole.
Let's go. That's awesome.
Yes, sir.
Well, we're getting close to the end of our time.
Absolutely.
Is there anything you want to leave the voters with, you know, just a few days before the big day?
Well, the choice has become really clear here in the final days. I'm a conservative Republican who runs a small business and has been endorsed by President Trump and, you know, dozens of former and conservative legislators. My opponent is a liberal trial lawyer who has sued Oklahoma farmers and ranchers and their business partners and been okay with putting in jeopardy 25,000 poultry industry jobs, which is pretty important to Southeast Oklahoma.
That's huge industry, and
Eastern Oklahoma, so he could enrich these liberal Democrat trial lawyers that have been prosecuting this absurd case the last 20 years that was started by a liberal Democrat attorney general. So, you know, we're hoping that the true conservative Republicans pay attention to, you know, the facts versus the falsehoods and are quite excited that when true conservative, you know, Republicans choose freedom and faith and great financial accountability principles, and we all unite around a solid plan, we can usher in a golden age of growth and opportunity for our kids and our grandkids. So I sure would appreciate everybody's vote out there on Tuesday, August 25th. For additional details, they can go to our website, mikeforok.com. And I'm just grateful that I get to talk to you guys, you know, a couple days before the runoff. And thank you for how you serve the people of your community and working so hard and sacrificing what you sacrifice to keep people safe.
Thank you for that. And
yes, sir.
I can't wait. I think we'll have another episode one of these days.
Yes, sir.
And go over everything we talked about today and you know, prove that the votes were cast well, you know.
And there's a Thunder game
Let's
in our
it.
Future.
Yeah, there is a Thunder
Let's
game
do
in
it.
That future.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your time today.
Okay. Thanks, Jay. Thanks, Shiloh.
Thanks, Mike. We'll see you later, man.
That's Hosting Hochatown. Peace.